From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the federal government starts sending aid checks to help farmers hit by the president's trade war with China.
It's a nice check to get, but I'd rather have the markets. All of us farmers would rather have the markets than a check in the mail from Uncle Sam. This helps somewhat, but it's not going to solve the issue.
Dirt City Sanctuary, a community-based residential rehab facility coming to West Michigan.
You know, there are so many things that cause people to use, and how are we doing with helping get rid of each of those barriers so that you want to stay clean, so that you can love life again?
And the early signs of the cancer that claimed George Gershwin at age 38.
He was smelling burnt rubber, smell of burning tires, he said.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump's $250 billion in China tariffs are fully in place. Now we see how this trade war will affect consumers and producers. Michigan's farmers and growers are bracing for impact. With us now, a soybean farmer from Columbus Township in St. Clair County. He's also a director on the National Soybean Board. Jim Domogalski, welcome. It's good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you, and thank you for calling, and I'll do what I can to inform the public of what's going on today.
I think a lot of attention, unusual attention, is being paid to soybean crop and soybean farmers because of the tariff issue. And we are hearing this year is going to be bringing a bumper crop for soybeans. Do you agree with those ag experts?
In our area here in the county and the surrounding counties, it looks pretty darn good. We don't know for sure what we're going to have until we get that combine running in the field. But our beans in this area do look above average, yes.
And when we say a bumper crop, what are we actually talking about?
I think it's anything above average, five or six or seven or eight bushel, maybe 10 bushel above average, whatever that might be. But our average here in the county, I think it's the mid-40s, maybe a little bit higher, but it just appears that they're looking better. The beans are tall and pretty clean, and there's a lot of pods there. And tall doesn't really mean good yields, because it's the seeds or the pod set on the plant itself. If the pods are set closer together up and down the stem, that means a lot of beans. And it looks pretty good.
And when you say mid-40s, for those of us who are just kind of clueless about this, when you say mid-40s,
okay,
what do you mean?
Bushels per acre.
Ah, bushels per acre.
Bushels
okay.
per acre.
And how does a bumper crop affect markets and farmers?
I'm going to go back to the Chicago Board of Trade. They'd go by estimates, and there's people throughout the government that go through certain states and estimate yields best they can. And these estimates are looked at by Chicago Board of Trade, and they look at that through the amount that there's going to be produced through the state, through the country. And those are speculations, but they're fairly close. And it kind of makes a farmer nervous when they say a bumper crop, because when the yield goes up, the price goes down. Along that with the tariff price, it's not a happy harvest this year.
You know, it's basic supply and demand, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Basic plus supply and demand, you're right.
But then you factor in the tariffs.
Yes. And that's not a friendly issue with the farmer right now.
All right. Talk about what that effect has been on you.
Well, initially, the price dropped and it kind of stayed there about 25% of less of what it was in about the March-April area, or whenever that tariff came into effect. But it's even dropped more. I think we've lost about 30% of our price from this spring. That's going to sting us pretty good, especially the guys that did not contract ahead of time when the bean price here in Michigan was in the high $9 area. And right now it's in the mid to lower $7 area. We're going to have to really tighten our belts with that price.
Jim, what kind of payments and what kinds of expenses come due for farmers after the harvest?
Property taxes come at a certain time of the year, and that's a hefty one. It's either property tax or rental. Farmers rent land from other property owners. And our seed price has dropped slightly. It depends when you buy. If you buy your next spring product, whether it's seed or fertilizer, if you buy it October or November of this fall, there is a discount. But that's a long ways. Put your money ahead 6-7 months ahead before you plant your crop, and a year ahead before you receive your product, your harvest. So if you got money stored up or saved up from previous years where you can take advantage of these discounts, it's a pretty good thing. But there's not a lot of wiggle room if you don't have a lot in savings. So a lot of farmers go out there and borrow for their inputs. And hopefully they'll get their crop off, purchase their inputs, and wait till next spring to plant their crop.
So many things you're juggling, trying to figure out what might be down the road.
Oh, yes.
Welcome to the life of a farmer, right?
Well, weather is a big issue. That's one thing we cannot control. Hopefully we'll never be able to do that in the future anyway. I don't want to do that. You mess with Mother Nature, and sometimes it stings back at you. This year we've had extremely warm weather this year, and that the crops responded very positive to that because we had good moisture with that. That's what brought what they call a bumper crop or above average yields, the way we look right now.
And so here you have this bumper crop, this above average yield. So what about the demand for that crop?
That's another issue. Since the tariff issue, China, which in the past several years has taken 60% of our exports, that's 60% of what went out overseas went to China. With this tariff issue now, that's dropped. I can't give you a big figure on it, but I know it's dropped significantly. Now, what China's done is bought and ordered more beans from Brazil and Argentina. And those two countries down in South America will not be able to, my estimation, will not be able to supply all the beans that they need in China. They have a very large animal industry in China. These animals, after they've been fed soybean meal, and it's a very good protein value for the animal, once they've been fed that, they're used to it, and they see the advantage of the soybean. And they're going to try to find alternative markets because of the tariff. But still, here and there, they're going to buy some loads from us because the other countries won't be able to supply them with the demand.
But not what they've been buying.
Not what they've been buying.
So what do you do with an excess of soybeans? You store them? What happens?
We will sell what we need to pay our inputs as a farmer. And being a director on the United Soybean Board, we have people with feet on the ground in countries around the globe knocking on doors in these countries of promoting the soybean meal and soybean oil as food for other countries. And some of these third world countries, they're just getting up to speed on some of this protein value thing. Mm. But they can only take so much. Mm-hmm. Trying to get a foothold in Europe of more beans exported there. We're just banging on all kinds of doors anywhere we can in the globe. And another thing, with the price the way it is at the pharma gate, it's pretty low. And that travels right through the system. So these other countries that need soybeans or want them, now's the time to order and buy. Mm. The price is low for them.
If you just joined us, we're talking about soybean farming in Michigan and the challenges, particularly with the trade war with China, as we talk with soybean farmer Jim Domogalski, who's also a director on the National Soybean Board. So, Jim, as President Trump and China keep slinging these tariffs at each other and escalating the trade war, the federal government has started sending out checks to farmers to help them cope with the tariffs, $25.8 million going out to farmers in September under this bailout program, which the administration says will eventually add up to $12 billion. Have you or anyone you know requested or gotten any of this assistance?
Yes. I myself and some of my neighbors are going to go look at this. We're calling it a Band-Aid package right now. You know.
And why is that?
Because they're basing it on $1.65 a bushel of the crop we harvest this fall, but 50% of that crop. So say if a guy has 10,000 bushels he's harvested, they will pay you $1.65 on 5,000 bushels. So it's kind of a Band-Aid. Yes, it's a nice check to get, but I'd rather have the markets. All of us farmers would rather have the markets than a check in the mail from Uncle Sam. This helps somewhat, but it's not going to solve the issue.
What are your thoughts as you watch this trade war escalating between President Trump and China?
I can see his, as I look way out in the distance, I can see his reasoning for this. But as farmers, we dislike it because it's really hit us right in the pocketbook. And this 25%, is, as far as we're concerned, is way out of line. Mm. It's way too much. I don't mind paying some, but I don't like the idea of this whole deal. I don't know what's going on in the White House right now as far as his true end result. But the man is a businessman. And I have confidence in him, but right now, it's kind of, I'm a tongue-in-cheek with what he's done to us, to the farmers. I'm somewhat confident that in the long run, this is going to pan out. Well, it has to, because you're going to put a lot of farmers out of business with these kind of prices, especially young farmers that have started out there. They want to be a farmer. They want to raise crops, and they borrow sometimes $1 million or more to get started. Farming is not a cheap business to get started with, because you cannot make a living on a farm like they did years ago on 40 acres or 80 acres. It's got to be a lot of acres if you want to be a full-time farmer. The cost of machinery, fuel, inputs, fertilizer, seed is a lot more than it was a few decades ago. And in farming, everything else has gone up. A pickup at that time in 1965 was probably under $3,000. Today they're $40,000. And the prices we're receiving at the farm gate are a heck of a lot better than them. We're in the 60s. Yeah, they are somewhat better. But the only way we can get a good profit is maximum yields. We have to do everything we can humanly possible to get that yield up to our average or above our average yield. And the rest is up to Mother Nature.
Jim Demogulski, soybean farmer from Columbus Township, who's also a director on the National Soybean Board. Thanks for the farmer's view, Jim. It was great to talk with you.
It was great to talk to you, ma'am, too. Appreciate the call.
Coming up, we talk about how to address our state's teacher shortage.
Practices such as allowing teachers an extra 45 minutes, say, to do some collaboration or to prep, those things are disappearing. And that, you know, with the addition of more students in the classroom and more paperwork, is just causing a lot of chaos.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A very fitting way to mark this day, the 120th birthday of George Gershwin. He left such a tremendous mark on American music despite his short life. Gershwin died of brain cancer when he was only 38. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is with us now to celebrate the too short life of George Gershwin. I know the New York Times wrote in those years after World War I, Gershwin was to music what F. Scott Fitzgerald was to prose.
Isn't it a lovely line?
It is a wonderful line. So let's start right at the end of his life. He went into a coma July 11th, 1937.
Yes, but the symptoms really began earlier, around February 11th, to be specific. He was performing with the Los Angeles Symphony Orchestra his Concerto in F, which is not as commonly performed as some of his other pieces, but is well worth listening to. And Gershwin, of course, was a wonderful pianist. And so he was playing the piano solo, and he had what we now call an absence seizure, where you are sitting or you're standing or you're in a position that you were. You don't collapse, but you lose consciousness for 10 or 20 or 30 seconds. And he actually missed several bars of the piece. And then he woke up and resumed playing. He also reported having an olfactory hallucination. You know, hallucinations are not just what you can see. They are sometimes what you hear, and in this case, what you could smell.
What was he smelling?
He was smelling burnt rubber. Smell of burning tires, he said. And he saw a doctor and no one really knew what was going on with him, of course. It was quite early in the history of neurosurgery, let alone brain cancer, and his symptoms were rather vague. You know, he was depressed. He was neurotic. He was irritated. He was irritable.
Had he had a personality change in the months leading up to all of this?
Or? Well, Gershwin had a very interesting personality to begin with. Some would say he was very full of himself. Dizzy Dean would say, you know, it ain't bragging if you did it. And so he was very proud of his accomplishments, and he was, after all, George Gershwin. He was the greatest composer of his era.
And he's in his 30s.
Yes. And he was not just composing Tin Pan Alley songs or hit musicals. He was also performing classical pieces that were being lauded and played in symphony halls all across North America and in Europe. So he was quite a big deal. And he would refer to himself in a third person. You know, Gershwin did this. Gershwin did that. So he was known for being a difficult handful. And he was, like many many people of his ilk, somewhat neurotic. But he started having terrible headaches as well. And he started, after February of 37, started having more of these episodes of absence seizures, of headaches, of smelling burning rubber.
And nobody could put it
together. No. He was seeing a psychoanalyst at the time. And finally, the psychoanalyst said, you got to see an internist and we got to get you worked up. So he went and had a full battery of tests at the Cedars of Lebanon Hospital in Beverly Hills. And they didn't find much. They wanted to do a spinal tap, which might have been diagnostic in terms of the cells that they discovered. They might have seen malignant cells in his spinal fluid. But he said, you know, that I don't want to go through that. It was a very painful procedure. Yeah. And he didn't want to go through it. So he went home. And then he became more depressed, more irritable. He had several episodes where his headaches were so blinding he had to leave. He was once at a dinner party thrown by Irving Berlin. Boy, I'd love to be at that party. And another, a luncheon with Paulette Goddard, who was Charlie Chaplin's wife for a few years. She was in Modern Times. He fell in love with Paulette, but she spurned his affections. And that made him very sad as well. But nobody really knew what was going on.
And did you say at one point somebody sent him home with a diagnosis of hysteria?
Yes. Yes. So male hysteria was a diagnosis invented by Sigmund Freud in the 1880s because no one believed that men could become hysterical. After that point, then sure, there are a lot of men who are hysterical. I think I'm one of them. But he was sent home with a psychogenic diagnosis. So it was in his head. They didn't really realize how right they were.
So what happened July 9th, 1937?
Well, as he got more irritable and difficult to handle his own daily functions, a male nurse was hired, and Ira Gershwin came over, his brother and lyricist. They were both in Hollywood, by the way, writing a musical for Samuel Goldwyn called The Goldwyn Follies. And George was asleep all day. It was till 5 o'clock in the afternoon that he woke up, and he was so weak that they had to literally pick him up and put him into bed. Very quickly after that, he fell into a coma. They rushed him to the hospital, to Cedars. And the neurosurgeons there contacted Walter Dandy, who was the greatest neurosurgeon of his era. He was at Johns Hopkins. He was actually on the eastern shore of Maryland with the governor of Maryland on a cruise.
So he's on the other side of the country.
Other side of the country, and they're connecting. You know, this wasn't the era of cell phones or even long-distance lines, so it was a very difficult chore to get him connected. He left immediately, but by the time he got to Newark, New Jersey, to get into the train to travel to Los Angeles, which would have taken several days, they had already rushed him into the operating room for brain surgery.
And then from there?
There was such a large tumor, a glioblastoma, which is the same tumor that killed John McCain a few weeks ago and killed Ted Kennedy a few years back.
And Beau Biden.
Yes.
Senator Biden's
son. It is the
son.
Most common form of brain cancer. It's very aggressive. Today, after diagnosis and initial surgery or treatment, people live 12 to 18 months. Back then, you were diagnosed so late. There's no CAT scans. There's no MRIs. And plain x-rays, there was something called a ventriculogram, which was actually invented by Walter Dandy, where you injected air into the spinal column by means of a lumbar puncture and you try to delineate if there's a tumor or not with air acting as contrast, it's not a very good way to look at the brain. It's also very painful.
Okay, so that...
So there really wasn't a lot you could do back then.
He went into the coma July 11th, and when did he die?
He died shortly after coming out of the operating room. He never regained consciousness, so he died the next morning at 10:30.
Would there have been any real value in an earlier diagnosis?
Well, you know, Walter Dandy made a comment about that. There wouldn't have been. There was no real chemotherapeutic agents or radiation therapy that would have helped. He would have gotten progressively worse and lost milestones. And as Dandy said, for someone so brilliant, for a genius like this to rapidly decline and lose milestones in terms of what he could or could not do would have been sheer torture.
The too short life of George Gershwin on this, his 120th birthday. University of Michigan medical historian Howard Markell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Who will stand at the front of the classroom teaching Michigan's kids? It's an urgent question because there just are not enough qualified teachers to fill the need in Michigan schools. One way to quickly get aspiring teachers into classrooms is something called alternative certification, training programs that don't require any in-classroom student teaching. Is that the answer? Well, let's dig into all of this with Matinga Regetz, who is Michigan Teacher of the Year in 2011. She was inducted into the National Teacher Hall of Fame in 2017. Matinga is a new regular contributor to Stateside, and she's with us now via Skype. Matinga, welcome back.
Hi there, Cynthia.
So, Matinga, what do you see as being at the root of Michigan's teacher shortages?
Well, this is definitely lunchroom conversation. And I can tell you, it's definitely an agreement that this is a manufactured problem. The whole teacher shortage and the whole exodus from the schools is a byproduct of this mountains and mountains of policies, education policies that have been made by people who have really forgotten the purpose of school, right? And so the focus, though, is not really on the obstructions and all of the obstacles in education right now. And I think that the main reason why teachers are leaving their schools is not the job, the rigors of the job. Like, it's not the pay. It's not the evaluations. Most teachers are like, bring it, right? But what's really at line here is the cost to our mental health, emotional, physical health. And all based on these cocktail of factors that are raining down on the profession right now.
And then what are you hearing from teachers about the pressure that shortages create in a school system for teachers and the impact on kids in the classroom?
Yeah, I spoke to many teachers. I particularly loved a story by Janice Cato. She's from Hemlock Public Schools. And so she wanted me to remind people about the fact that, you know, teachers spend upwards of 30 hours a week with your child. And it is very important that that parents understand the needs of the teachers and what's happening to teachers right now, because teachers need to feel supported. They need to be able and free to care for the kids.
What kind of pressure do shortages create in a school system?
Well, for one, like in any job, when there is a man down, there's more work for everybody else. And so what is happening is that, practices such as allowing teachers an extra 45 minutes, say, to do some collaboration or to prep, those things are disappearing. And that, with the addition of more students in the classroom and more paperwork, is just causing a lot of chaos.
And then for kids, so for the youngsters sitting in the desk, how are they feeling this?
Well, kids absorb anything that goes around them. They're like little sponges. And, these brave teachers are coming in day in and day out and making sure that these problems stay out of the classroom's threshold. But when you do not have enough teachers to go around, it really robs the kids of an opportunity to learn. Simple as that.
One of the ways that is being tried to address the teacher shortages is this alternative certification program idea. So programs like Teach for America or the for-profit fast-track program, Teachers of Tomorrow. So putting teachers with very little classroom experience into classrooms. Do you see this as part of the solution?
Well, there are many schools of thought on this issue of bringing short-track teachers into the classroom. First of all, it's really like a chilling development. And so
why is that?
Why is it chilling?
Some feeling that we, you know, maybe you're setting some of these teachers up for failure because of they have less preparation, mm-hmm. right? But on the other hand, we also believe that individuals that are coming out from the workplace and into the classroom, they offer a unique perspective and with their variety of careers to enrich the students' experience. And also there is a lot of teachers who believe like, listen, lowering the barriers into teaching is more in line with the current pay teachers are getting compared to their college educated counterparts, right? So yes, this is a crisis and it's all hands on deck. And we as teachers respect any committed individual that is willing to join us on the front line.
Well, let's talk about which kids are most likely to have these short-track teachers, the alternative certifications. What do those demographics look like, Matinga?
Right. So it's like any social experiment. The brown and black kids are predominantly the ones who are on the front line for getting the short-track teachers. Is it better than no teacher? Yes. We don't know if it will prove to be a temporary solution to a permanent problem if we don't start addressing the big elephant in the room.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Matinga Ragatz, Michigan Teacher of the Year in 2011 and National Teacher Hall of Fame from 2017, our new regular stateside contributor. What is the elephant in the room, Matinga?
Well, the focus right now is the focus on not how the kids learn, but who has the power to determine what kids learn. Hmm. And if we have that table conversation, I think we'll begin to understand the problem.
Can you explain what that means?
Well, I believe that there are current forces, right, trying to dissolve what's happening, especially in the public schools. And rather than just bringing a very transparent agenda and saying, listen, from here to, from 5 to 10 years, we're just going to dissolve the way teachers are, the teacher structure. It's become this underhanded, let's just make it so hard to stay that people leave so that we can place, we can bring in the individuals that support our ideology.
I want to step back, Matinga, and talk about what it takes to become a good teacher. What skills does a teacher need before reaching the classroom?
Well, because of the changing times, with technology, I believe you are seeing right now like the return of the artisanal teacher. And this is a teacher who can take any ingredients and create this fantastic learning experience for their students. This is, I think the growth of this teacher is to mitigate the scripted box curriculum. When it doesn't work, this teacher is the one that we can count on rather than the one that just follows the recipe, right? Mm. And so this teacher, the artisanal teachers, they have the knowledge of how the brain works and they make things relevant and instantly current to the student and applicable to the students. And they have a really deep understanding of social curriculum. And by social curriculum, I mean like health and wellness of this child, how to teach him empathy and how to mine his talent, how to understand his potential, how to make things different so that so every child gets the same experience, right? Besides the content, mm-hmm. those are the skills, the real skills that it takes today to be in the classroom. And it really comes from an emotional commitment to and a respect for individual, like the individuality and the uniqueness of the student.
And right? I think I kind of hear you say passion is a big part of it.
Yeah. I think it's beyond passion. It's a talent.
Passion. Okay. Mm. Yes. And so the talent we're talking about and these skills, mm-hmm. do they have to be learned in the traditional teacher education model?
My opinion, I don't think so. Teaching, like I said, is a talent. It's like music is a talent. Yeah, you can learn how to play an instrument, but that doesn't really mean that you can play, right? Mm. But you can learn a thing or two along the way that helps you hold your own. So I don't necessarily believe that the formula is in the traditional model or in these new short track models. And I think the skills and the commitment to the job and the profession is what it takes.
And can you envision a different way of filling these teacher shortage gaps apart from these alternative certification short track programs?
Well, if like a realistic problem or a, hey, if I had a magic wand problem.
Let's start with realistic. Realistically speaking, where we stand right now.
Well, realistically speaking is the fact that the teachers and educators are dealing with a problem that we cannot solve on our own. Realistically speaking, these SORTAC teachers are really going to fill the need that we have, especially in schools when you have upwards of 300 vacancies come September, correct? But if I had that magic wand, I would definitely really concentrate on changing the nature of the profession, paying teachers more, respecting their college degrees, giving them autonomy, allowing them to master their own profession. And that's what I would do to just attract more people to the profession rather than make it difficult for them to stay.
Hall of Fame teacher Matinga Ragatz is an instructional innovation consultant and speaker. Matinga, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is a slippery slope from addiction to homelessness and worse. Tyler Trowbridge was on that dangerous descent, addicted to heroin, living on the streets of Grand Rapids. But thanks to a high school friend and other friends, Tyler is in recovery. And they've all united to create a new way to help people struggling with addiction. It's called Dirt City Sanctuary, a community-based residential rehab facility. Let's revisit our conversation with Tyler Trowbridge, along with his high school classmate, Stacy Peck, and Wendy Botts. The three are the founders of Dirt City Sanctuary. Here's our conversation from earlier this year. Well, Tyler, take us back a few months to the beginning of the year. You were still using heroin.
Yes, ma'am.
What was your life like? Where were you living?
I was living anywhere I could sleep. I was homeless, out when it was 10 below zero, I was out there. When it was too bad, I would go from business to business just to stay warm. And luckily, I developed, some sort of friendships with, there was a guy that worked at a Speedway, and he'd let me stay there until he got out of work at 5 o'clock in the morning. And then there was a Tim Hortons that opened at 5, and they'd usually let me hang out there. So I'd basically go from business to business just to kind of stay warm.
How long had you been using?
Over 15 years, or almost 15 years.
Okay, so that's a long, long stretch. And I think there are many who would say it's actually amazing that you are still alive after 15 years.
For sure. I mean, I was overdosing almost every night. The 9 out of the 10 days before we started this, I was waking up in the ER. I was blacking out in fast food restaurant bathrooms or any bathrooms I could. And then they would find me unconscious and then call the police. And so they'd be dispatched. They'd come in seeing me either passed out or stumbling around. And then they would call the ambulance and then make me go to an emergency room just to check me out, make sure I'm okay, and then release me.
And back to it. Rinse, lather, and repeat over and over. Stacy Peck, you're watching the local TV news in Grand Rapids last winter, and you see your classmate from Grant High School. What was that moment like?
I honestly couldn't believe it. The fact that it was winter and the fact that he was homeless, all of it just completely broke my heart. And Grant is a very small town. Everyone is close. Tyler and I weren't necessarily friends in high school, definitely knew of him. And I remember him just as being this nice guy. So when I saw him living outside, addicted, and at the end, he just said, they asked him, do you think you're going to die out here? And he said, yeah, I probably will. And he said that he wanted to live. And that part just, I mean, all of it got me, but it really just, I felt like he needed help.
Did you drive around to try to find him? How did you connect with him?
So he was utilizing a drop-in center in Grand Rapids, and we contacted the executive director of that organization who had a way to get in touch with him, and she said, he'll actually probably be here on Monday. And I said, okay, if he comes on Monday, tell him to wait there for me. I'm going to come there.
And what was that moment like, Tyler, when you come in and you find out that somebody from years ago in high school
is reaching out to you.
It was crazy. Well, because the director had texted me and said, hey, a couple friends from high school led by this girl, Stacy Peck, started a GoFundMe for you. And she was like, yeah, within like a couple hours, it was already $1,500. And at this point, it was like over $3,000. And I was like, oh, like it blew me away because these were people like I felt like I was pretty shy in high school and, you know, not really outgoing. And I was like, man, I didn't even know these people knew who I was, you know. And then to see them all coming together and just like donating their hard earned money to help me was just amazing. And then she told me they were going to come on Monday. And like the first thing I was like, man, I'm going to leave. Like I didn't plan on staying. Like she actually showed up before I could leave because I was going to take off. Because I'm like, man.
A little overwhelming?
Yeah. I was like, I stink. Like I don't feel good. Like I don't want to deal with these people. So
you didn't want people to see you?
No. No, not at all. So I was going to take off and run. And then I went outside to smoke a cigarette, and there's Stacy Peck pulling in the mom-mobile. And I'm like, oh. And then I was like, maybe she didn't see me. But then she looked at me and waved to me. So I'm like, oh, I'm stuck.
I'm caught. Mm-hmm. And isn't that a good thing as
yeah,
we sit here
it's
now?
It's amazing now.
I want to find out now, Wendy Botts, you guys are friends, right, mm-hmm. Stacy? And
yes.
How did you get involved and why?
Well, Stacy actually messaged me about a half hour before she was meeting with Tyler. We are friends, and she knew about my story that my son Jordan passed away. It hadn't been quite a year at that point from a fentanyl overdose. And she, like Stacy had said, raising the money was the easy part. It was his network, you know, the support he was going to need afterwards that was important. So she called me and asked me if I could meet her at UA. And I said yes, and I left my house and met her there. And I just didn't hesitate because partly from the aspect that he's important and I didn't need to know Tyler to know that he mattered and that he deserved knowing that people still cared about him.
And that seems to me to be kind of the foundation of the idea behind Dirt City Sanctuary, because you've taken you've all taken this. It's quite amazing. And you have kind of joined in and worked with architect John Witten of Spark 43 Architects, a social justice architecture firm, to come up with this 501c3 nonprofit, Dirt City Sanctuary. What do you want it to be?
We want it to be a place where people can come and regain their lives, regain the ability to be a normal part of society, to feel that they are loved. You know, our success isn't going to be measured in how many days clean we can get you. Our success is going to be measured in how have we come alongside you to remove your individual barriers to staying clean. You know, there are so many things that cause people to use, and how are we doing with helping get rid of each of those barriers so that you want to stay clean, so that you can love life again?
So tell me what it is that you want Dirt City Sanctuary to be. When you get this built and you've got it up and running, what will it consist of?
First of all, each person will have a home. It's going to look like a large farm community almost. So we're kind of calling it a campus. So each person will have a studio apartment that they get to be a part of decorating and finishing up and that kind of thing. So they'll have a home. Then they will have a community. So they can go down to the lower level of the home, and there is always going to be another human being on that first floor in the communal space. So if they just need to tell someone, I'm feeling like using right now, or I'm having a hard time, or I just want to sit in the same room as someone else and read this book, they will have that. They will be able to get a job. And whether that's with us, you know, one of the things we're planning on our campus is a large workshop that so we can train people on how to do different construction projects, things like that, that, you know, helping Tyler, everyone kept saying to me, oh, you're just an angel for doing this. And I try to explain to people, helping him has been one of the best, most fulfilling things I have ever done in my life. And I want to be able to give that to these people who come to us.
And Tyler, based on all those years that you were caught in addiction, and I know, tell us where you're at right now. How long have you been in recovery?
It'll be 13 weeks.
That's great.
So it's amazing. I mean, you know, some people look at it as, oh, you only have 3 months. Like, that's not anything. But, you know, I've been doing drugs for 15 years, and I never had more than a day or two, ever. And, like, unless I was in jail or, you know, never. So to me, it was like, to me, in my heart, like, I know I'm done. It's just the way I feel, the way, like, I sabotage my ability to use almost every day. Because anytime I leave my apartment, everyone knows me. Like, I was on the streets, you know, I've had countless drug dealers. I'll run into a drug dealer, like, you know, and these drug dealers are like experts in psychology. They'll be like, oh, so now you got some clean time. You know how to maintain and you can just dabble a little bit, and trying to give me some free bags. Like, oh, here you go. Because they know as soon as I get that one hit in me, as soon as I start smoking, they're going to have everything I own. Everything I have that's valuable or important to me, they'll own. All my money from my bank account will be in their pocket. I'll be on the street doing the same thing. Because once you start, you can't stop until you have nothing and everything's gone. And, you know, and you lose everything. You burn all your bridges. You lose your support. Your family hates you. Your friends don't want to be around you. And that's, like, a big thing that we're trying to do.
What do you see Dirt City Sanctuary being able to offer folks as you get this up and running? And it would be a resource to people who are where you were.
Yes. Well, a big thing we're going to do is, I mean, we're going to be huge on community. For, like, me, when me and Stacy started this, she actually had to leave town for about a week. So what she did is she filled my schedule with volunteers. Like, some of them I knew, a lot of them I didn't, just to come and hang out with me. You know, in the morning to take me to treatment, in the afternoon to take me to lunch or for something to do, in the evening take me to dinner or for something to do. You know, and just having those people was key to me. So, I mean, that's what we want to do for people, is build a new community around them. So we're going to pull in all these volunteers, and we know we already have a lot because everyone wants to help. So it's like, if you have a Saturday off and you want to take 3 or 4 people out to the movies, you come and take our people out, and maybe you get along really well with 1 or 2 of them. The next time you come, you say, hey, I got along with this person. I want them and some new people. And then naturally, you'll build these new bonds. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of these people that Stacy hooked me up with are my really, really good friends now. This girl, Chelsea, every Monday she comes to hang out with me. Like, she's one of the key people. Like, if I'm having a crappy day, like, I can call on her no matter what. If I need anything, she's there.
And you didn't have anybody.
I had none of this. So, like, yeah. She built this community for me out of nothing. Like, these people that didn't know anything about me, except for they knew, like, I'm a human being and that I deserve love and deserve respect. And, you know, that was everything for me. And that's something I never have. And I think that's the difference now. That's why I'm able to stay clean no matter what.
And if you fall off that recovery wagon, people are there to help you get back.
Yes,
again.
And that's what we believe in. We're not going to give up on you. You know, if you make a mistake, if you slip up, we're going to be there. You know, and we're not going to start over again. We're just going to keep going. We're going to keep doing what we're doing, what works. And, you know, we're not going to give up on you. We will be there. We will give you love. We will help you get what you need to get.
Stacy said when she called you, Wendy, I think you and Tyler will be good for each other. How has knowing Wendy changed you, Tyler?
Oh, it's amazing. Like, she's been a mother to me. It's like having someone that just loves me. And no matter what, when they first met me, I didn't have anything. I didn't even have shoes. And me and her son kind of had, like, the same style. So she went home right away, got me a pair of his Chuck Taylors that, like, I live and die by Chuck Taylors. You know, that's my style. Went and got me a pair of Chucks, went and got me some clothes, a warm sweater, one of his coats. Like, you know, just she's been really amazing, and she's been a really valuable part to the three of us. Like, we all, like, have our really good things that we add to this, and
each brings something.
Me and Stacey couldn't do it without Wendy.
And Wendy, what about for you? I mean, no one heals and recovers from the loss of a child. You learn to live with it.
Yes, as all my mothers in the grief group say, it doesn't ever get better; it does get easier. Mm-hmm. And doing this project with Tyler and Stacey, and just being—it's more than a project. No matter what comes out of this, the friendship that I've built with the two of them is the greatest gift that I have.
You've called this a European model of recovery.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Well, in Europe, they take more of a not just treating the addiction like we do here. It's treating the whole issue, housing the person, mental health aspects, a home, everything that's needed to move a person from addiction to recovery. Because just getting someone off drugs doesn't deal with the heart of why they're using. And ultimately, if you don't deal with the heart of why they're using, relapsing is inevitable. Mm-hmm. I mean, so and here we do. We have a catch and release sort of program, particularly with the criminal justice system. And on average, the average stay in the U.S. for detox is 3 to 5 days. We get a person clean enough, we clear the drugs out of their system, and then send them back out with no resources, no networking, nothing. And that just doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense for long-term success.
So give them a place to live, yeah. Make them a part of the community.
Yes.
Bring people in that can be mentors.
Definitely. Yes.
It's all there. I have to ask, and I'm going to go to you, Tyler, what's the significance of the name? What does Dirt City Sanctuary mean?
Okay, so me and Stacey are from Grant. So Grant has a lot of muck fields. It was like Rice Lake was drained, and we were like the onion capital of the world for a while. So anyways, there was a bunch of us that played music, like a bunch of punk rock kids, and we were called the Dirt City Rockers.
Tyler also, when we started talking about a name, you know, he wanted to stay away from rehab or anything like that. And so, you know, I just said, what about Dirt City Sanctuary? Because it's sort of this, you know, we want to give these people their lives back. And I think we'll be impacting those individuals, but then we'll be impacting their families. Yeah. We'll be impacting the people that never thought that these people would get clean. That's something that we hear a lot with Tyler. People say, if you can get clean, man, maybe I can. I mean, he was among the worst of the worst.
I was the worst of the worst, like, seriously.
Well, you can learn more by going to the website dirtcitysanctuary.org, dirtcitysanctuary, all one word, .org. And we have been talking with the founders of Dirt City Sanctuary with great plans for Kent County and beyond, Tyler Trowbridge, Stacey Peck, and Wendy Botts. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you,
Cynthia.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
A quick update from the team at Dirt City Sanctuary. Tyler is now coming up on 7 months of sobriety. Stacy tells us it's been an incredible experience to watch his journey and how he's transformed from homeless on the verge of death to advocate and resource for people battling addiction. After a long wait, the group has received their official 501c3 status, and that allows them to move forward with more fundraising efforts. And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on and issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. And a note before we go, today's show featured some interviews that aired previously on Stateside. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joy Horan, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.